This podcast contains themes that might be difficult for some people to listen to, including discussions around depression and suicide. If you prefer not to listen to this episode of Breaking Ground, we'd be delighted if you could join us again next time. You can also find some useful links to related support services in the show notes. About 3 weeks ago, I was sat in Cafe Nero on one of my non-working days as part of a phased return, and I took a selfie and put it on LinkedIn saying, I've had a terrible time of depression, but I'm on my way back to work. If anyone wants to cheer me on, please feel free. And it's been viewed over 50,000 times and 100 odd comments. Somehow I broke the algorithm. I cracked the algorithm. And people from 20, 30 years ago cropping up on my timeline and offering friendly words. It's been absolutely incredible.
Hear more from Jim and his mental health story after this message from our sponsor.
Central Piling are proud to sponsor the Breaking Ground podcast. It aligns with our goals of providing technical expertise, continuous improvement, and community engagement. These are things we've been striving for since our inception over 40 years ago. Some of the engineering achievements during that time include the design and construction of the foundations for West London's tallest residential building, complex 3D finite element analysis to facilitate the creation of a triple story basement, and damage impact assessments for underground assets on a rotary cased piling contract. Our plant includes a wide range of board piling machine sizes. These are continually being updated to ensure emission regulation, compliance and efficiency. We're also able to offer driven precast and steel piling on selected contracts. To learn more about what we do and discover details of how we might be able to help you on your next foundation or retaining wall scheme, visit centralpiling.com.
Today I'm joined by Vicky Gutteridge of the Ollie Foundation. The Ollie Foundation, well, Vicky's going to tell us all about it, but they're a charity focusing on suicide and bereavement within young children and adults. And I'm also pleased to say we're joined by Jim Gelder, Technical Director at Mott MacDonald. Jim has been very vocal and has indeed shared some videos talking about his struggles with depression. So I'll be really keen to share his personal experience on the podcast. Vicky, let's come to you and hear all about the great work that you're doing with the Ollie Foundation. Maybe, I don't know, it's a sad start to the story. Tell us about where it all began.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks so much for having me on. It's lovely to be here. Yeah, so the Ollie Foundation, it did start off in tragedy. It was set up in 2016 by three parents that lost their sons, teenage sons, to suicide. They were all based in Hertfordshire and they all went along to their local SOBS group, which is Suicide Survivors of Bereavement Support Group. And whilst they found that talking really helpful, they kind of wanted to do something really constructive that was going to ideally prevent anybody else being in the situation that they found themselves in. So they got together, they started off with a fundraiser, a golf day, and then that 3 days later turned into the Ollie Foundation. And it's gone from strength to strength. So that was 5 years ago. So the mission really that Ollie has is to make sure that not a single young person feels that suicide is their only option. And we do that by delivering suicide awareness training, intervention, prevention, advocacy. As I say, we're based in Hertfordshire, but due to COVID and going online, we've kind of gone global, really. We've been taking our trainings and our panel discussions and talks as far as Korea, the US, Australia, and it's been really accessible over lockdown. So we have about over 20 training offers. Some of those are face-to-face, which I'll talk about a little bit later on. And we're just delighted to say that in these 5 years, we've trained over 10,000 people in suicide prevention. So it's great to be here just to kind of get awareness of the Ollie Foundation, and we're out there online ready to help for anybody that wants us.
Yeah, and I should stress that it's not just construction related companies that you deal with and individuals, it is across the board. But of course, we're here as a construction podcast and we're talking about this issue because it's such a big problem. Suicide is the biggest cause of death in men under 50, and construction workers are the highest risk group for that. And I think later on in the conversation we'll maybe explore a little bit more about why that might be the case. But I wonder, particularly with your focus being on children and young adults, which, okay, we don't have children working in the construction industry, but we've got lots of parents clearly who are going to be touched by these issues. But what are the biggest concerns? I mean, growing up so different nowadays to when I was younger, social media clearly plays a big part in that. I'm sure there's lots of other things, but what have you gathered in terms of your knowledge? Where do the biggest hazards lie for our children?
I think you're right, Steve. There's so many hazards, actually, and there's so many layers to them, and they're cumulative, aren't they, over the course of life. It's almost like sort of Jenga blocks. So sometimes it's not one individual cause, but it's just a slow increase, little steps and little stages that actually, if you took any one of them, you might be able to handle, but layered on top of each other, at one point that Jenga tower sort of falls over. So I also am the schools lead at the Olley Foundation, continuously talking to universities, colleges, and all sorts of schools, things such as the academic pressures and worries are often the big thing that they are concerned about. An immense amount of pressure these young people have these days in terms of employability and direction. And obviously COVID's affected that, where their future lies. That's a huge thing for young people. Bullying is another reoccurring issue. And of course, that's multi-layered with social media too. Social isolation, or everything that we've seen over COVID, the fact that, and that can continue even as the pandemic is easing, this the kind of languishing is quite a big thing at the moment. The sense of, there isn't that sense of urgency or anxiety that we had at the peak of lockdown. But what do we do now? Because we've all experienced a huge amount of trauma over the last 2 years, whether we recognize it or not. And a lot of trauma is unspoken about, just it's felt within you. You don't have the words for it. And maybe that sense of languishing and just things are feeling foggy, things are feeling like you've got mud in your wings. I think that's a huge thing for young people. And then the common things of bereavement, family environment, substance abuse, all the things that we experienced when we were younger, these are all just these Jenga blocks that we see in young people. But I would say if I was to record a conversation with teachers, university lecturers, over and over again, it's the same thing. And it's this academic pressure that they're putting on themselves. And also identifying with a mental health need. That's a huge thing. Emotional contagion. It's almost, you know, you've got one person struggling in a group, and the emotional contagion can go around like dominoes. And that can be a huge issue, supporting others, bringing your own mental health down whilst trying to be helpful, not knowing how to put a boundary in place to keep your own self safe as well. And that's huge for a young person who's holding secrets of a friend. And of course, adults have all the safeguarding training and all of that, that, you know, as a professional working on the front line with colleagues, you have that training, you're expected to. But what about if you're that young person or the colleague that is always going to be more approachable, but they don't know how to deal with it?
So you get into a really negative spiral. I mean, those things in terms of achievement, they, I guess, have always been there. Has the statistics got particularly worse, or is it just that there's more support out there, quite rightly, for the young people in this situation? Are you aware of numbers changing in terms of suicides?
Yes, Steve. So really interestingly, we attended the National Suicide Prevention Alliance conference 2 weeks ago. And against what you would, what the media kind of, the sense that the media would put out of the last 2 years that we'd experienced, you'd imagine that suicide rates have shot up. But actually, that's not the case. In fact, in this country, suicide between the children aged 10 to 24 has actually reduced by 30%. So there's a number of factors why that is. And one of them could be the sense of social cohesion, that actually during lockdown from 2020 to 21, which is when we've got the stats from, because we haven't got them since October 21. One of the factors, social cohesion, it was okay to be vulnerable. The stigma surrounding mental health had been reduced because everybody was in that situation. We had, you know, streets with WhatsApp groups. It was okay to ask, are you okay? Is it hard? And it was all right to answer no, I'm really struggling. So there was that sort of support in place that may have been preventative. But the bad news is that the actual reporting of support for CAMHS and support in terms of eating disorders, self-harm, all of these things have had a huge, huge spike. So it's almost okay. Like we had a pause during lockdown where people were held, but they turned to coping mechanisms. So we see that they were rescued and safe from suicide, but they've been using these coping mechanisms, really harmful harmful ways of supporting themselves. So here at Ollie, we're desperate to get into schools and into workplaces to support that fallout, because now the adrenaline's gone, now the pandemic is easing, and we're expecting to see over the next 3 to 4 years maybe that increase going up at a steeper level. I really hope that's not the case, but possibly.
Yeah, I feel like people are more open to honest conversations around the mental health. So hopefully that'll be reflected. Certainly there's been a lot of good work in the sports media, for instance, bringing into our attention professional footballer and rugby player struggles with mental health issues. And I think when you see your favourite celebrities and your peers talking about these things, it normalises it. And clearly talking about it is a big step forward. And yeah, but really encouraging news on the actual suicides. One thing that really shocked me and disappointed me, so I read the other day that there's actually websites out there that help people that want to commit suicide. Is there any legislation going through Parliament to try and get rid of these things? I mean, is it even worth trying? I mean, it seems completely wrong that those sorts of sites should exist.
It's an excellent question, Steve, and something that is actually happening right next week. There's an organisation called Ripple, and they were set up a year ago by a wonderful woman called Alice Hendy, who sadly lost her brother to suicide. Now, Alice is a formidable woman with a technical mind. She was already in that industry, and she has set up a tool called Ripple Prevention. It's a tool that you can download on your browser, and it interrupts any harmful search. So it's exactly what you're talking about. Her brother Josh took his life after searching for suicide techniques online. They sadly found out. So this is what her tool does. And instead of when you type anything into your Google search, it'll come up. If you've downloaded it on your, which you can do for mostly for free, if you're an organization, charity, or young people, or a family, and it will come up with a conversation with you. Are you okay? It gives you a breathing technique. And then if you were to do it currently, you would just simply get the Samaritan's helpline. So if you put anything into suicide, okay, You'd get the helpline. If you're a 16-year-old, I mean, my 15-year-old does not like to text, to pick up a phone and talk to a soul. That'd be the last thing she'd like to do. So she's not going to phone Samaritans, but she might text somebody. So there's a number of different, and you might perhaps write something. You might like to go onto a website and write something to get help on a support line online. So that's what Ripple does. It puts all of this intervention online. And actually, we're going to Downing Street next week with Ripple. The Ollie Foundation are as well, along with the Ollie Lee Trust, who've set it up at iHeart. And we're going, and Ripple will be talking about that at number 11, because we need to make a change and we need to make these things happen. So watch this space. There are some other people within government who are working hard to make that happen as well. So it's It's certainly being recognised. It's in a conversation, but to actually change the browser would be the most important place to start. But whilst that's unavailable, to be able to download the Ripple tool would be great.
I know there'll be people listening that thinks, well, if somebody wants to commit suicide, then they're going to do it anyway. But that's not actually the case, is it? If you put sometimes literally barriers in place to stop people taking that final step, then it can delay it long enough for somebody to change their minds. You know, that you hear about people on bridges, somebody comes along, has that conversation, and it completely changes their life and they talk
That's
about it.
You just need that interruption. You just need somebody to sort of switch a little light on, just distract, just to make you think, because you can be in your own bubble and it's just an interrupter. Yeah, absolutely. You're so right with that. Just a conversation, a tap on the arm sometimes is all it takes. And online, it's the online tap on the arm that you need.
Yeah. So suicide obviously is the most extreme example of the effect of mental health problems. But we all experience a real range in mental health challenges, you know, from just everyday stress. I mean, sort of how we get by as people and survive as humans, that sort of fight or flight. And one of the aspects that I'd like to talk to Jim about is depression, because Jim, you've been struggling with this for how long now?
It's about 3 years now in this particular episode, and I had another one that lasted about a year in 2007.
Yeah. And how does it manifest itself with you? I mean, you have good days and bad days, presumably. What can you sort of describe to somebody that's perhaps not struggled with it, or not known people close to them that have struggled with it, how they would go through a day dealing with depression?
Obviously, it's different for everyone, but I think there's a common theme in people that have got into serious depression, the depression that requires medication, counselling, perhaps a psychiatrist, that sort of thing, is that you're no longer yourself. You can't recognise yourself. You find yourself doing things in ways, or doing actual activities that just don't feel like the person that you used to identify with. You mentioned the video I put up on YouTube. There's a really good book called Darkness Visible by William Styron, who's a Pulitzer Prize winning author who suffered depression in his 50s. And even an author of that calibre and skill was unable to describe adequately how it feels. I pulled up because there's a couple of fantastic quotes that I use quite a lot when I speak to people at work. One is, he says, "Depression is a disorder of mood so mysteriously painful and elusive in the way it becomes known to the self, to the mediating intellect, as to verge close to being beyond description."
Sounds quite poetic.
It really is. To discover why some people plunge into the downward spiral of depression, one must search beyond the manifest crisis and then still fail to come up with anything beyond wise conjecture. So complex are the intermingled factors of abnormal chemistry, behaviour and genetics. Again, very poetic. I talk a lot about the chimp brain or the lizard brain. At the end of the day, we're very, very, very sophisticated animals, but we're animals, we're creatures. And probably, I don't know the statistic, but I imagine 90% of what we are is animal. It's evolved over millennia. And that chimp brain, that emotional part of us, the fight or flight type reactions, where all our emotions are processed, is so powerful. It's so much stronger than our intellectual part of our brain. And so once the rot sets in there, and you have a series of self-fulfilling prophecies and feedback loops that just make things worse and worse and worse. And so he talks about the pain of so many victims as the mind continues its insidious meltdown.
The chimp brain, that's something that the Steve Peters book talks about. In fact, he did a sequel which was more focused on parenting, which obviously is relevant to this discussion as well. You mentioned the lizard brain. I've not come across that one before. Is that just a sort of a different name for the same idea?
I think it is. I've heard lizard brain from parents when we've been talking about the same thing. It's the very animal bit, the part of your brain that controls how your little finger moves when you're not thinking about it.
Right.
The part of your brain that makes you blink. That sort of thing, you know, but it's all powerful. Steve Peters talked about the chimp being 10 times more powerful than what he calls the human brain.
Yeah.
And so really, you know, the way I have felt it has been as that chimp brain taking over and sabotaging me. And I guess the difference between being stressed and anxious and being depressed and anxious is really when that tip occurs and you can no longer reason with your chimp and it starts to sabotage you and take you down. My GP talked about capacity and demand, and she said that really depression occurs when your demands have outstripped your capacity for a long period of time.
So what I wanted to ask you, Jim, was how did construction play a part in it? Was that a causation factor? And how have people within your business and perhaps other stakeholders like clients and subcontractors dealt with your illness?
So work played a factor in so much as it was one of the demands. So this balance of capacity and demand. And certainly work was a very big demand on me at the time when things first broke. I mentioned at the start that I'd had a depression previously. It was a bereavement-related depression while I was isolated from friends and family. We were living in Dubai when I lost my mother, tragically. And so I'd been through the process of becoming depressed, but also the process of it blowing itself out and coming out the other side. And because of that, I got a lot of techniques, and I also was able to recognise in myself the warning signs early. And I was fortunate enough. I've got a fabulous employer, Mark McDonald, have been absolutely wonderful. Yeah. I was able to speak to my management and send up a red flare. And we were able to sort out somebody to succeed into the role that I had and take the project on. And then we got re-rolled at work and took those work demands right down.
That's good.
Client, absolutely fantastic. We were working for the Environment Agency and working in partnership with Bam Nuttall. Everybody tremendously understanding, sympathetic, some wise heads. More people than you can imagine have been around this block, particularly as you get into later life. So I had people coming from all sides of the team I was working in, offering sage-like wisdom or just a bit of support. So blessed in that regard. All three companies have on site and in the offices the phone numbers of support lines to call. So I did that and got some counselling through the company in the early days.
Well, that's
so lots of things that are offered. I took advantage of them all. It just so happens that I've got a troublesome depression that has lingered this time. Because of that, complex intermingled factors of abnormal chemistry, behaviour and genetics. You know, it isn't caused by one thing.
No.
It's caused by the multitude of demands that come across your whole spectrum in life.
Yeah, thank you, Jim, for sharing your story. I'm sure your experience and the support that you gained through this period and that's ongoing will give others that are suffering confidence that they can talk to their employers and that people will be sympathetic. You mentioned there about your family bereavement, which I'm sorry to hear about. Maybe come back to Vicky now and talk a little bit about coping mechanisms for bereavement. But everybody's going to deal with it in different ways, and sometimes you hear about HR systems saying, well, if it's direct family member, then you get so many days off, and if it's sort of a cousin, you can go off for the funeral. But that's really too rigid, because relationships are so complicated and different. Somebody might be really close to a grandparent, but not very close to a parent, for instance. What recommendations would you give for anybody that's dealing with bereavement and companies that are looking to support those individuals?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think in the first stance, it's important to say that the Olly Foundation, being working in the arena of suicide prevention and intervention, we deal with the suicide. We often support those who are bereaved by suicide. So that's what I can speak of today. And I think often it's really useful for companies to get guidance, because at the end of the day, talking about bereavement is really difficult anyway. Talking, if you layer on suicide on top of that, it's almost impossible to speak of, and that's really natural. People find that really difficult. So I think my biggest piece of advice, well, there's a number of things that you can do, but to be able to say something is better than saying nothing. And often people feel that the last thing you want to do is talk about it. I wouldn't say their name, I'm going to upset you. People who have been bereaved by suicide are living with that. That's in their heads 24/7. There's nothing you could say that's going to trip them up and remind them. They're living it. So that's quite an encouraging way to know that you can do that. There's an amazing book, I don't know if you've heard of it, called Help Is at Hand.
No, I haven't.
It's you can download it or you can get it online. If you go to the Olly Foundation website, we've got it on there under Help and Advice. And it just is a fantastic read for those who have lost somebody, or employees or friends or families, of what do I do now? And in there, it includes conversations that you might just like to have with your colleagues. So often the fear is when somebody is returning to work, how are we going to cope with that? And they suggest something like, you know, Vicky's coming back to work on Monday. Most of you know that her daughter died by suicide a month ago. And Vicky wants everyone to know that her daughter took her own life. As you can imagine, the whole family are reeling with shock and grief. But she's asked me to tell you that she doesn't mind people expressing their condolences, but would prefer not to be asked about the details of what's happened. And I think sometimes that reassurance of very clearly, a clear set of instructions is really helpful. And I know personally, a friend of mine lost her husband to suicide, and part of her grieving was to write a list of what would be helpful and what wouldn't be helpful. And she shared that with her colleagues, and she shared it with friends and family. And as a friend that didn't want to upset or say the wrong thing or put my foot in it, suddenly I understood what she knew, and she didn't have to say it. It was written. So that might be a tool that, if you are supporting a colleague, that might be something that you could do practically, to say before they return to work, how would you like us to do? What would you like us to do? So not assuming you're doing the best for them, actually directly asking them how they are. What would they like? What wouldn't they like? That is a very helpful thing. I mean, we're going into an August, in fact, we're going into schools, but it could apply to any organisation. We're running an online session, and it's for those schools that have lost a colleague to bereaved, not necessarily to suicide, throughout COVID. And an opportunity to stop as an organisation, if you have lost a colleague, to say their name, to recall stories, as a memorial, really, to be able just to pause, because so often we go on without talking and covering it up. And in Britain, we're classic for that, aren't we, of just keeping going, carrying on. But actually inviting those that wish to come to pause, to remember, to talk, to know it's okay to do so, might be really helpful too.
Yeah, that's lovely. I was just, when you were saying about people coming back into work, I was thinking there might be a temptation to say to an individual that's suffered a loss, oh, don't come in, you know, almost push them away, perhaps because individuals within the rest of the team might feel a bit awkward. But of course, the priority should be for the individual that suffered the loss. And I guess for certain people dealing with bereavement, actually returning to a normal routine and interrupting that sort of sole focus of sitting at home and thinking about their loss, actually it could be a really positive step for them.
Absolutely. And also, you know, it's okay to say, I just don't know what to say. Like, you know, it's okay to be really vulnerable. And I think it's better to say something like that, to say, I don't know what to say. I haven't got the words, but I'm here for you if you want to talk, or I'm thinking of you. You don't have to say something really eloquent. Just saying, I just don't know what to say, but I am so sorry, is enough, because somebody knows that you're there. You haven't ignored them. You haven't crossed the street. You haven't sort of, you know, avoided the water fountain kind of thing. And also, some people we've talked to, Ollie, through our grief cafes that we hold, people have regrets about things in the past, that they never did that they crossed the street. And from what I've heard from people with lived experience, it is never too late. So if you're like listening today and you think, well, I don't speak to my neighbour and she lost somebody 3 years ago, it's never too late to say, I didn't know what to say at the time and I'm really sorry, but I really felt for you and you're in my thoughts. And that's so comforting to somebody, because they do understand how people are feeling. They understand the pain, but it's never too late, you know. So if you're listening to this and you feel, I should have said that, there's something that you can still say.
Can I just chip in on that as well, just from the other side of that? I've had so many people say lovely things to me. I get told an awful lot I've been really brave because I put a video up on YouTube and a post up on LinkedIn. And I suppose it did take a bit of guts to put it up, but not an awful lot. And the response has been overwhelmingly good. And for me, it's really buoyed me. So, yeah, absolutely agree, Vicky, that as the sufferer, if you make open your vulnerability out, people respond to that in a really kind and positive way.
Let's bring it back again to the construction sector. We hope to be joined in a future episode by Mark McBride Wright, who's from Equal Engineers. He's been doing some work on a topic called toxic masculinity, and some of our listeners might have completed one of his surveys over, well, there was one out a couple of years ago and another one that was circulated in the final quarter of last year, and there'll be some discussion around that. And what I wanted to discuss with both Jim and Vicky was why construction has such a high suicide rate and what we mean by toxic masculinity. I think, Vicky, this is a term that you have come across in the past.
That's a really good question. And I think I have to just identify that. What is toxic masculinity? I mean, it's that sense of male toughness. So much we kind of think it's that sort of macho workplace culture. And it's toxic because it's basically largely responsible for you and your colleagues' mental health, for good or for bad. So there's this sense of, like, say, banter surrounding a toxic masculine environment. On one hand, that banter is a relief mechanism. It offers humour and it allows workers to blow off steam. But on the other, it can create that culture of not going deeper, no deepening conversation. So you can talk about the weather, the TV, what's happened last night at the pub, but of course you're not going to go dig any deeper. You're not going to be vulnerable. You're not going to show and share any personal problems or leave anyone struggling. And I think researchers can define it as a set of behaviours and beliefs. So it would represent a lack of emotion. So suppressing emotions, masking any kind of distress that you might have. It's going to be a self-sufficiency. You don't need any help. You don't need any support. You can do this on your own. You've got this. And maintaining that appearance of hardness. There's also that dominance and sexual virility that's an indicator of power, that tough guy kind of behaviour. And then within all of that, you can define it by strength, the sense of all of that equals strength and maintaining that appearance of hardness.
And that's what we've come to expect from our, particularly our leaders within the construction industry and other industries as well, that we think people are going to be quite hard, that the perhaps some of the more traditionally feminine characteristics, the empathy and sympathy for people, they're not considered as important qualities in leaders as some of those other, shall we call them, skills or that you mentioned before, that people look for in their, particularly their male leaders. And I do think that it poses so many different challenges, of course, for the mental health of people working in the industry, but also when it comes to recruitment and retention of, well, it's not just women, you know, there's lots of young men that might not consider a career in the construction industry because they're aware of the cultural implications and how they would be expected to behave in order to get to the top or even just to exist and enjoy their career.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think it takes on many forms. And I think there's something to be said about, it could be said about new generations coming forward, you know, that actually that this kind of sense of masculinity will be diluted when there's a shifting of ideas. I can see that is possibly happening already in certain areas. Again, it's always defined by a combination of behaviours and culture of age, race, class, sexuality, religion. So it's very nuanced in different cultures. It's very different, and therefore it can take on so many different forms and subcultures that view masculinity in a different way. But I do feel it is a very shifting idea. And like you said, I don't want it to be to have a brush tarring everybody in any industry with that, because of course at the heart of all of this is fear. You know, the root of that toxic masculinity is fear of not performing, not being accepted within the culture of what they believe, or fear in the stories of your past, or fear in the stories of your future. But I think at the soul and heart of everybody, there's a huge, as Jim's saying, you know, there's a huge range, wide range of emotions. We're all dependent on each other. We're all vulnerable. We can all cooperate. We all have kindness at the core. And we can all have a softness. It's learned behaviour, so that's a positive.
Yeah, and it's interesting actually. You mentioned subcultures because you're probably not aware. So Jim works for Mott MacDonald, who are a consultant business, and clearly he's there with an employer that you said very supportive of his situation. It's quite different, I think. I don't think I'm being unfair and I'm making false generalisations here. But within contracting environments, the expected behaviours are slightly different. So contractors, so the people that are out there actually building things out on the site as opposed to the sort of the designers, do have very different cultures. And I've worked in both, and I'm sort of in a hybrid of the two, in that we have a design department and we have a construction team, and it probably is a mixture of both cultures. But I do get to peer into both worlds, and I can see it's an extremely different culture, and it probably wouldn't be suited to certain types of people in a contracting environment as a consulting environment.
Steve, can I just offer a counterpoint to that?
Yeah.
Safety in the modern world is all about behaviour rather than being about PPE, which it might have been 20 years ago. J.M. Bentley, a part of the Mott MacDonald Group, a contractor, and they've driven quite a bit of the narrative around behaviours for us. And the time I spent on site in JV with Bam Nuttall, again, toolbox briefings, but brief backs and encouraging communication at the place of work in safety has come on leaps and bounds, and that behavioural change has driven through that construction end. So I'm not doubting what you say, that there are macho elements in parts of contractors. That change is years, if not decades, away.
Yeah.
But at the same time, contractors really do steal the march in some instances on behavioural change coming from that safety aspect.
That's true. And to be fair, you mentioned their name there, BAM. They've done some tremendous work in terms of well-being, flexible working practices, diversity and equality, and have won a number of awards. And we hope to have them on a call in the future. Jim Shields been heavily involved in their work and is agreed to come on in an episode, I think, later on in the spring. So look forward to discussing all the good work that's going on within that organisation. So what else can we do to encourage? We can highlight those good practices, as we will do on this podcast, and we can talk about what's good and what's bad. I think it probably stems from getting more greater gender diversity or general racial diversity as well within our organisations, and that can start at quite a young age. And it's important that we do engage with schools and universities to improve our performance in those areas. Let's talk now about training. So we'll rewind to the work that Vicky's doing on suicide prevention. And Vicky, I know you said you go into different organisations. We're not going to have time to do a full-on training session here, but perhaps you could give us a taste for what happens in the sessions that you do, how it would work if people were to engage with your business, and some of the key takeaways that maybe people haven't got time to do a full session, but there might be a few bullet points that you want them to just take away and share with some friends and colleagues.
Yeah, thanks, Steve, for the opportunity to share that with you. So the Ollie Foundation website, theolliefoundation.org, has a list of all of our trainings online, so you could go and have a look on. Some of them are online and they're free, they're open to the public, and they're listed on our open calendar. But we also can do in-house training and tailor that training to the need of the workplace. So very much seeing what your challenges are, talking to you about your challenges, and really sort of varying the training specifically to reach your need as well. But the main training that we do is in suicide prevention. So we have a training session called Talk Safe, Plan Safe, and it's a 2-hour session. And basically that runs through with anybody that has had previous mental health first aid training. Perhaps they've been on a safe talk suicide prevention, and it could be simply a refresher, or it could just be for somebody that has no idea what to do. They're a starter, they just need some confidence. Perhaps they've got a role within their workplace of a well-being lead or safeguarding responsibility, and they just need some training to know where to start. So we'll start by talking about signs that you could spot or not. What we don't like is there's some training that's out there that talks about spotting the signs. And whilst it's absolutely fantastic for those parents or friends that have lost somebody to suicide, to know that there were any signs to spot is heartbreaking, because you don't always spot them. So I'd like to say to spot or to not spot, because sometimes you just cannot see anything, and that's the truth of it. But what you can do, if you are concerned about somebody, you might just see a shift in their behaviours. So you might see that people are starting to perhaps not turn up for work or not performing properly, or maybe their usual standard has slipped. It could be something as simple as their hair's growing out, they're not getting a haircut, they don't seem to be eating, or they're overeating, they're eating really unhealthily. Or it might be a shift in a personality. It might be that they're quite quiet, withdrawn, or maybe they're really being outlandish and their behaviour has changed. You might see them being really vulnerable and crying, or you might see them sort of shutting down, not talking at all. So there's all kinds of things that start to change. And one thing to mention is that sometimes you can see people going through a really dark time, and suddenly there's this light relief, and you think, oh, wow, they've got it together, they're okay. But actually the relief may have come because they've made their mind up, they have a plan, They know, I'm really, you know, it's hard to talk about it, but they know what they're going to do. They want to take their life. And now I feel okay because I know that's my option. So that there's that change in behaviour too. So it's really important to note as well that if you are on antidepressants, when you've been prescribed antidepressants, obviously, you know, you've decided to take them. You feel they're going to help you, which is great. And many people do. And that's fantastic that it's there. But within 2 weeks of taking antidepressants, we know that the effects are that it gives you from being so within that dark hole, it might give you just that energy to carry out a plan that you had. So it's really important to state there that also if you know somebody that's just started taking antidepressants, you might see that they feel that they're coming out of that bleakness, or they may even drop down. But I couldn't leave you today without mentioning that actually sometimes the antidepressants just give you that energy to carry out the plan that you had for suicide. So that's really important too.
So what would you recommend people did? So if they're going to go on to a course of antidepressants, obviously talk to the doctor about how they're going to deal with it, but should they like have a buddy that they're sort of a check-in with along the way?
Well, this is what the Ollie found. That is why we're going to Downing Street actually on Tuesday to talk about exactly this. So we're very much lobbying the government and talking to local health organisations to put a safe plan in place as part of the prescribing, at the point of prescribing. So as you would if you're taking antibiotics and your doctor might say to you, look, if you have any adverse effects, if you start to have stomach cramps or anything like that, do let us know, we'll take you off and we'll try something new. Often when you're prescribed antidepressants, the doctor might say something to you like, yeah, if you start to feel under the weather, do come back. They're not specific about if you start to have thoughts of suicide, this is what you need to do. So our plan is to support GPs and pharmacists alongside the NICE guidelines and within an allotted time of an appointment to inform the patient of the risks attached, so they have informed consent, so that when they take their antidepressants, they also take along with them a safe plan, which could be an online app or it could be a written document. And that's set off by the doctors so that they understand that they are vulnerable at that time. And I could talk a bit about a safe plan later on, and do come on to the Talk Safe Plan Safe Training because it's all in there too. But they would start that conversation off with their GP. They would go to the pharmacist and they would continue and complete that safe plan with the pharmacist. And of course, on repeat prescriptions and review and online and on the phone, that would be reviewed. So the prescription goes hand in hand with the safe plan. It's a combined document to keep somebody safe. And a safe plan is essentially ways of staying safe, keeping yourself safe for now. In the same way that you, say if you had a puppy for a weekend and you were to, you're going away and you've got to have somebody looking after that puppy, you need to list absolutely everything it needs to do. And that's what you would do with this with a person at risk. So you would have a list of contacts of who do you feel comfortable calling in need, what areas do you feel vulnerable in, what part of the house do you not feel safe in, and remove yourself from those areas. Where do you feel safe? Are you staying or living with anything that makes you feel at risk, so knives or medication, anything like that that they can identify that could be removed? But then also more holistic things. What distracts you? What's your favourite TV programme? Because as Jim will well know, when you're in that moment when your prefrontal cortex is hijacked and you're not thinking rationally, who could even remember what's your favourite film or what you like to eat? And sometimes just having this list written in on your fridge that you can turn to, because at one point somebody supported you to write that. So distraction, and we're not talking, you know, distraction sounds like you're not dealing with the problem, but the key thing is keeping somebody safe for now. So
yeah.
So taking 10 minutes away from that thought of suicide would save your life by just watching Friends, perhaps, by pushing that down the line.
Yeah, it's getting support, obviously, is crucial. Now, producer Ben, in fact, I mean, it's done a tremendous job with us over the years. Thank you for all your work, Ben. Ben's involved in an alcohol support network, and really positive. In fact, I joined one of his calls last year, and there's lots of people that are struggling with alcohol abuse on there. Obviously, similar things go on for drugs. I guess with maybe depression and with people that are at risk of suicide, putting groups of people that are suffering together, is that something that is viewed as positive because of the concerns that you raised earlier there, Vicky, in terms of if somebody says something negative and it brings down others that are trying to support them? If you've got lots of people that are struggling, is that a good support network, or should actually somebody that's really struggling with their mental health just rely on support from people that are probably in a much stronger place?
Yeah, I think we'd always say if you're concerned that somebody's at risk from suicide and you are a friend, family member, colleague, you're not in a position to keep them. You're not qualified. I mean, I'm certainly not qualified enough to support them through that. I mean, that would have to be going. I would certainly suggest if you feel they're immediately at risk, it's a 999 call, or it's a okay. Or you take them to A&E. If they're telling you they want to take their life and they don't feel that they can stop themselves, then you go to A&E. And if anything, that's an interrupter. It just takes them out of where they are, and there you are at A&E, and suddenly you're in an environment where you're taking seriously and you're talking about it. But what you can do is you can write the safe plan with them, but ultimately it's down to that individual. So no one person can save that person's life. You can write the safe plan with them, and you can guide them to safety through crisis support lines, such as what we've talked about previously about Samaritans or Shout or Calm. Any of those support lines could help to talk people down from that sort of really crisis moment when they're feeling the fears and they're up on a high scale of anxiety and overwhelm at that moment. But yeah, it's very true that if somebody has told you that they want to take your life, you can support them to a certain extent. And we here at Ollie, we continually talk to parents. We are there for supporting parents with a child in crisis, and they live 24/7 on a suicide watch, and then their own mental health is suffering. And ultimately, there is a point in their life where their child has got to fledgling fly the nest. And there's that sense of how do they deal with that? How are they at that point of not being too codependent? Because at the end of the day, they need to have the resilience themselves. So ultimately, you can support to a certain extent, and you can be there to a certain extent. But it's really important to note that there are professionals out there that you are guiding people to. And that's the ultimate direction that we would recommend everybody takes, so you can keep them safe for now until that professional support can come into play.
Okay, there might be a case of maybe talking to their friends as well to try and understand exactly what they're going through, and trying to assess yourself whether there is a need for intervention professionally.
I think you just ask the question. Never be frightened to ask that question. That's the first thing we would always say at Ollie. Okay. So there's always this huge fear that if I ask, are you thinking of suicide, that might just put the thought in their mind.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
That's what people are going to think. And if I mention that, they wouldn't have ever thought of it. And evidence goes to show that's not. In fact, you know, Jim's shaking his head. I'm sure you might want to come in here, Jim. You know, sometimes it's the question you wished for years somebody had asked you, you know, that actually somebody just was to give you an opportunity to talk about it. So we would always say the first thing you can do is listen to their story, and then you can say something like, I've noticed that you haven't been coming into work, I've noticed that your work has slipped, your standards aren't the same as usual, but I'm concerned about you, you're not eating healthily, I've heard something's going on at home, all of these things are making me have concern about you, and I'd like to ask you, are you thinking of suicide? Now, if they're not, they'll just say they're not and be grateful to you. But if they are, that's your door opener, that's the way in. And we can skirt around the issue, but actually, especially as an employer, you know, that's when you're going to open a conversation and be able to support?
Yeah, gosh. That's a tough question to ask someone.
Well, come on our assist course, because we have this a 2-day assist course where you do practical role play and you don't even know you're doing it. You start off just everyone's interjecting, but by day 2, you're doing a very emotional role play. And it's practice. Practice it in the mirror, you know, because you're right, Steve. That would be totally my response too. Before I worked at a suicide prevention charity, I would find that difficult too. But the assist course is a practical 2-day course. It gives you that opportunity.
I'm fortunate that I've never got to quite the place that Vicky's talking about, but I've come a lot closer than I would often like to admit. And we've talked it through in therapy, and we've talked about practical things. So there's a stage that has been described of, I don't want to take my own life, but if I walked in front of a bus tomorrow, that would be okay. When I go to bed at night, if I didn't wake up in the morning, that'd be okay. And talking there about practical things, so like I commute on the train. And now, routinely, when the train's coming into the station, I stand and read a poster until the train's gone past, just so that if that urge were to come when I was in a dark space, I'm not going to do it. Taking extra care, crossing roads, things like that. You know, the things that help when you're in that space before. I don't know, Vicky, whether you've got any other sort of examples to add on that.
I think you're absolutely right. It's that distraction, isn't it? Is that what you're meaning, Jim?
Yeah, absolute distraction. Doing something active to take away the risk. Because there's a lot of time I've been mindful of what's happening. I've not been able to control it because I've become this different person, the person I don't recognise, but I've still been able to recognise that jumping in front of a train is going to end my life. And if I stand and read a poster at the back of the platform, that's a good thing to do. That's what I was directed to do by my therapist. And there's a bunch of things that you can do in that space before. The other thing I wanted to touch on briefly was when you were talking about spot or not, and you went through a fantastic list. I think spot or not is something, if you can help people to do that to themselves, because very often by the time this downward spiral has taken hold, it's very difficult for the person to do anything. They're already becoming this different version of themselves. There's a really crucial window when these things are happening, whether it's overeating, undereating, looking unkempt, quality of work, whatever they are. If it's happening to you, you can observe those in yourself before anyone else can see them. And if you know you're looking for them and you know that you're going to get a warm reception, then I would say to the individual, speak to somebody you can speak to, whether it's a phone the helpline at work, because they're advertised. All the big construction companies now have a helpline that you can call. Speak to a friend, speak to a line manager. If you can honestly trust that you're going to get a warm reception somewhere, speak as soon as you start to notice these things. And then that's what happened with my case. I was re-rolled, got the stress reduced, and it helped a tremendous amount. So, yeah, I would say those spot or nots in adults, in the work environment, if you can see them in yourself first, that's got to be the best line of defence.
That's good advice. We're certainly seeing a lot more mental health first aiders within our business, and it's our ambition that we have as many mental health first aiders as physical health first aiders in the next couple of years. So I'm sure if that's replicated across the industry, it'll really raise the bar in terms of knowledge of some of these issues. And of course, the course that Vicky's suggesting there sounds fantastic as well. And hopefully leads to further reductions in the statistics that we were discussing earlier. Thank you both so much. Jim, keep up the good work.
Thanks
very
much.
Keep going well in your recovery. I'm sure there'll be lots of people reaching out to you after the hearing you on the podcast. My personal thanks to you. And Vicky, give us one more reminder of how to contact you to sort out a course.
Yeah, so the best way is to go to www.theollyfoundation.org. org, and that takes you through to our website, and there's a calendar on there of events, or on there you could, there's all our contact details, so you can phone up or email and we can do an in-house training if that's what you prefer, or you could just access our open training sessions that are online as well. So but really happy to have a conversation, just, you know, to pick up the phone, feel free to talk to me, just talk about your needs. You know, it's, if you feel like something's happened at your work or you just need to know more, we're really happy to tailor something to suit what would suit your workplace.
Brilliant. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having us on, Steve. It's brilliant to be here. Lovely to meet you, Jim.
Thank you very much indeed. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Breaking Ground. If any of the themes in this podcast have affected you and you feel as if you'd like some more information on further support, please see the links in the show notes.